Thank you for the invitation. So, let me start by saying that all of this is joint with Michael Grechenik and Dimitri Wies. Yeah, so what I want to explain to you is a certain theorem which will in the end simply tell you that certain pairs of varieties have the same Hodge numbers. And so let me first sort of tell you where this comes from. And okay, this is maybe something anyway which you guys know much better than me. This is all motivated by mirror symmetry, specifically by SYZ duality. Yeah, so I mean, in mirror symmetry, we have sort of mirror pairs, which are maybe the one to denote M and M dual of compact Calabi-Yau manifolds. And so SYZ duality somehow says that such pairs should somehow fit into the following picture. So we have our two complex manifolds, M and M dual. And then there should be a fibration to a common base, N, which is given by a smooth manifold. And these should be smooth projective. And furthermore, the generic fibers of these fibrations should be, there should be Lagrangian submanifolds for the symplectic structure, which one has an M and M dual. And furthermore, each of them should be a complex torus. And like if you look over a point in a generic point, these two complex tori which you get as the fibers should be dual to each other in the sense of complex tori. Okay, this is somehow This picture which is suggested by SYZ duality. And so in some sense, what I want to talk to you today is some kind of example of this. So let me make, however, some further remarks. So furthermore, one can generalize this. So here we just have manifolds, but there exists also a generalization which allows one to look at orbifolds M and M hat. And so this is something that I will talk about later. So this involves certain GM gerbs on these orbifolds. So in some sense, one has to introduce an additional datum to make up for the fact that one is dealing with orbifolds. So I will say something about this later. And then, so in general, what one from such a mirror symmetry picture, I mean, one expects various relations between M and M dual. Sort of the simplest ones is maybe the following relation for the Hodge number. So that HPQ of M should be H, say the dimension minus P comma Q of M, M hat. And so in fact, in the example which I want to talk to you about today, so this is not quite what will happen. So there will be some certain shift in these Hodge numbers. And so what happens is that if in addition you assume that this M or M dual are hyperkähler, and so this will be the case in our example. So in this case, we have an additional symmetry on these Hodge numbers, and so equally you can just expect that HPQ of M is HPQ of M dual. So you can also expect and so in fact in the example which I will show you today, what happens is that we have certain pairs M dual which will be hyperkähler, but they will be no longer compact. And so for whatever reasons, what happens is that in this non-compact situation, it is actually this identity that somehow survives. Okay. So this is somehow the general picture. And so let me explain the setting. So which?
So in the non-compact case, should I like have modified the first one to kind of have compact support or something?
Yeah. So you take homology with compact support, which still has a Hodge structure.
Okay.
And so in fact, yeah, I mean, I will also say something about this. But in general, the Hodge structures will no longer be pure. So you can somehow, I mean, in general, I guess what you can do is you can write down certain generating polynomials in two variables, which somehow keep like track of all the dimensions of the graded pieces in the mixed Hodge structure you get. But in fact, in our case, what will happen is that even despite the fact that we no longer have a compact manifold, the Hodge structures will still be pure. So you can still write down a relation like this. But I will say this later. But yeah, you definitely have to take cohomology with compact support. Okay, and so what are the spaces we want to look at? So this will be certain moduli spaces of Higgs bundles. So let me remind you what those are. So the setting is X is a smooth projective curve over C. So an algebraic curve. A priori, okay, we'll start out with the complex numbers, but then later on we will also work over different fields. And I want to take K, a canonical line bundle on X. So here, in principle, you could also take more general line bundles, and the story would somehow generalize, but I will restrict to this case. But then, okay, definition, a Higgs bundle. A pair e comma phi, where e is a vector bundle on X. Phi is a morphism of vector bundles from e to e tensor k. Okay, I mean, maybe I'm preaching a bit to the choir here, but let me make the following remark. If you have never seen this before, like some in some sense, why is this interesting? So you can maybe more generally, if you fix some scalar lambda in C, what you can do at, look at the map, let's call it nabla from E to E tensor K, which satisfies the following relation. So for F, a section of the structure sheet of X, and E in E, some sections, what I want is the nabla of FE, it's F nabla of E, and then the second term should be lambda e tensor the differential of this function. So for various lambdas, one can look at such functions. And so now what you see is, so if lambda is zero, we just get the Higgs bundles, which I just defined. And now if you take lambda, say, equal to one, I mean, you just get a connection on this vector bundle. And in fact, for any non-zero lambda, I mean, you can just sort of divide out by lambda, and you see that basically you have a connection up to some rescaling. And so basically what this tells you is that sort of, if you now let lambda vary, you sort of get this family where you deform connections into these Higgs bundles. I think this is in some sense why this is interesting. So in a moment, we will look at moduli spaces of Higgs bundle, and equally, if you look at this construction, you will sort of see that you have a deformation from the moduli spaces of flat connections to the moduli space of Higgs bundles. Okay, and so let's look at these moduli spaces. So let's fix some integers nd. And then what there exists, I should also say this will be very important. This is some assumption which I want to keep throughout my talk, is that this n and d are coprime. So then under this assumption, I mean, so for these Higgs bundles, like for vector bundles, one has a notion of semi-stability, and then for semi-stable such bundles, one gets a moduli space, which I want to denote by MGLND. So this will be a moduli space of semi-stable Higgs bundles of rank n with degree d. So this is a smooth, and so for smoothness, you really need this assumption here. This basically ensures that all semi-stable Higgs bundles are actually stable. So what you get is a smooth quasi-projective variety. It's this moduli space. Okay, and so somehow So if the main important geometric feature of this moduli space is the so-called Hitchin vibration. So what you can do is the following. So if you have such an E and phi, what you can do is you can basically consider the characteristic polynomial of this morphism phi. Look like x to the n, so ai x to the I. And now the coefficients of this characteristic polynomial, they will be global section of the n minus i's power of k. And in some sense, what happens if you like work locally on your curve x and trivialize k, and you really just have an endomorphism of E, and you can take its characteristic polynomial in the usual sense. And then if you think about what happens globally, as you see, you get exactly a characteristic polynomial like this. So how far? Is it OK if I
go all the way to the very end, yeah.
I mean, at some point it'll be a bit awkward to read, no? OK. OK, and then Hitchin proved that if you look at the associated map from Python, this moduli space of fixed bundles, well, the space parametrizing this characteristic polynomials, which is just the direct sum of all the spaces of global sections considered as an affine space. So this is a proper and surjective morphism of moralities. And furthermore, it's generic fibers. So one could say that the generic fibers are abelian varieties, but in fact, slightly more precise is to say that they are torsors under abelian varieties. Okay, so this means that you have certain natural abelian varieties associated to this situation, and on each fiber, like one of these abelian varieties will act simply transitively. And some of the point is over the complex numbers, you can just pick a point on your fiber and identify the fiber with the abelian variety. But in fact, later we'll be more over more general fields. And there you may not necessarily have actual points over your base field. And so somehow there this distinction will be more important. Okay, so we have this vibration, which is proper and surjective and generically at least very nice. And so this is the central feature which will later give us these vibrations over there. Except now what we also have to do is we have to consider more and more general structure group than just GLN. So let me tell you a bit about this. So in fact, if you take G any reductive group scheme over X, Then you can define a G Higgs bundle or Higgs bundle with G structure to be a pair again, E, phi. So now E will be a G torsor over X. And phi will be a section of the sheaf of, say, endomorphisms of E tensor plus K. Okay, and so then again, you can consider moduli spaces of such G Higgs bundles. And in fact, what we will be interested in is the case SLN and PJLN, so this pair of Langlands dual groups. And so in fact, again, what we have to do is impose a certain condition, like the one we had here on the coprimeness of N and D, to actually get a smooth moduli space, which will be very important. So the point is, if you just take the constant group scheme SLN, you look at SLN Higgs bundles, you will get a moduli space which is not smooth, because somehow then like the degree here would be zero. And so you have to do a certain twist. So what I want to do is L fix L a line bundle on X of degree D. And as before, I assume that this degree is coprime to N. And so then I can define twisted. So we have a twisted version of SLN by this line bundle. In fact, so let me just say what is a Higgs bundle with structure in this group. Well, it will be E phi, like the normal GLN, Higgs bundle. And now, furthermore, what I want is to identify the determinant of E, the vector bundle with L, an isomorphism like this. And I also assume that the trace of phi is 0, where the trace of phi is one of the coefficients of this characteristic polynomial of J. Okay, so for, like I said, for the usual SLN, you would here take the trivial line bundle. But it's important, again, to take this twist by this line bundle L to get a smooth moduli space. And then this goes through, so we get a smooth quasi-projective moduli space, which I want to be known by LSLN, MSLNL. Okay, and then we also need the PGLN moduli space. And so here you don't need to do any twisting. So what you just get is you look at the moduli space of all PGLN Higgs bundles of the given degree D. So however, what happens now? So this smooth quasi-projective moduli space. So this is still a variety. But now for PGLN, what we get is actually a stack, a smooth quasi-projective stack. So we no longer just have a variety. In fact, you can quite concretely describe the stack. So if you look at the group gamma, the n torsion of the Jacobian of X. So this will act on the moduli space of SL and L line bundles by tensor product, right? Because if you have these guys E here, E comma phi here, and you take an N torsion bundle and you tensor E with that, then this isomorphism will somehow be preserved. So you get this action of this finite group. And then what happens is that actually this PGLN moduli space is just the associated quotient stack. So we get these two spaces. And now, like before, we have Hitchin vibrations. So we have MSLN L. And PGLN D. And so now what happens is that you get a Hitchin vibration to a common base, which is almost the same as before, except that we have one less sum in here because we required the trace to be zero. And so these are again proper plus surjective morphisms of algebraic spaces. And this was somehow the observation of Hausl and Zadeus, who came up with this story. The generic fibers, well, again, they are torsors under abelian varieties. And now, this is somehow why I'm telling you all of this, is that, like, again, if you now take a point, a generic point, if these two abelian varieties, and this will now be dual in the sense of abelian varieties. Okay, so we really get something like in the SYZ duality picture, which I just erased. And in fact, I should say, to be quite precise, is that so before I explain to you how one also has this Dirac moduli space of flat connections. And so if you pass from the Dirac moduli space to the Higgs moduli space, in fact, what happens is that these two spaces are diffeomorphic, but the complex structure changes. Okay, so if you replace these two spaces by the corresponding Dirac moduli space, you still get the smooth maps like this, And in fact, it will be this pair of spaces that really satisfies the SYC duality picture. Okay, but what happens is, in some sense, if you do this replacement, the Hodge numbers don't change, so we can might as well work with these spaces. Okay, and then now I'm almost ready to state the theorem, which will be in essence that these two spaces have the same Hodge numbers, except that there is one further modification that one has to make, which I alluded to before. It's that because somehow this space here is now a stack or an orbifold, if you like, you have to introduce certain gerbs and twist the situation by that, in some sense, to compensate for the fact that you really have an orbifold here. And to put it differently, in fact, if you look at this, some of what is already suggested by the notation is that this side here depends on L, but this side here actually does not depend on the line bundle L we chose. So in fact, also from this, you can see that on the right side, we have to introduce some kind of modification, which depends on the line bundle if we want to get any statement.
So I'm not a very good algebraic geometer. How much extra information is there in L other than the degree D?
Yeah, I mean, you can still have like a... I mean, you still have a lot of different line bundle of the given degree. I think with the peak zero, which is some abelian variety, which like acts on them. Okay, and so we have to somehow like twist this cohomology, which we consider a little bit, and this somehow goes under the name stringy cohomology. So please don't ask me why it's called this. So like I said, like L over X, the line bundle. What happens is this induces a gerb, a GM gerb, alpha L. So i.e. an element of H. H2, so on the PGLN moduli space. So yeah, like this is a class in H2. So you get this gerb. In some sense, to describe this gerb, basically what happens is that so you have a canonical homomorphism from SLN to PGLN, an isogeny, and so if you have a PGLN Higgs bundle, can sort of consider all the possible lifts to an SLN Higgs bundle through this homomorphism. And in fact, if you look at the class of all these possible lifts over like varying bases, this will exactly make up a mu n gerb, where mu n is exactly the kernel of this homomorphism from SLN to PGLN. And then you can push this out to a GM gerb, and this gives you this gerb. You do it in the right way. Okay, and so then associated to this, a sort of stringy cohomology group, so-called, with compact support, and so these are again equipped with a Hodge structure. And so, yeah, I mean, I won't say too much about this. Basically, what happens is that so you have this gerb on the stack. And then for every stack, you can consider its inertia stack, which is like the moduli space of points on your stack together with an automorphism. And in fact, what happens is such a gerb will naturally induce a line bundle on this inertia stack. And then you can just look at the total space of this line bundle and take the cohomology of that. Okay, so for example, if one were to take the trivial gerb here, this thing would basically compute for you the cohomology of the inertia stack of this stack. But anyway, I mean, there's some twist, which is in some sense the right modification which one needs to make in this picture to make up for the fact that one is dealing with orbifolds. Okay, and then I want to state one last fact. And so here I wrote with Hodge structure. And so in fact, a priori, because we're dealing with non-compact spaces, one has a mixed Hodge structure here, as well as on the cohomology of the SLNL moduli space. But in fact, both of these Hodge structures will be pure. Okay, this here should be the C. And this in some sense just follows from the existence of the Hitchin vibration. And so the point is, I mean, like I said, it's very important that these two moduli spaces are smooth. And so because you're taking the cohomology of a smooth space, this will give you the one inequality of the weight. And then the second inequality of the weight somehow follows from the Hitchin vibration, because the Hitchin vibration allows you to compare the cohomology of the whole space with the fiber above the natural point zero in the space. And this fiber will be proper or compact if you want, and so this will give you the other inequality on the weights in the mixed Hodge structure. Okay, and so now I can finally state the theorem, which is, well, that the Hodge numbers you get in this way are the same. Okay, and let me note, so this was a conjecture by Hausl and Thaddeus. It was them who noticed this fact that in this picture you get this SYZ duality picture, and they also already proved this for n equals 2 and 3. Okay, so I've managed to state the theorem. Let me explain how we proved this. So this is where things somehow get quite a bit more arithmetic. So somehow, I mean, like the general idea is, why can you prove this here, is that sort of, unlike the general SYZ duality picture, I mean, here we really have algebraic spaces and algebraic maps. So we can do many things which we couldn't just do with differential geometries. So somehow the most important ingredient in the proof will be the Weyl conjectures, which I want to explain to you now. So this is somehow central result in number theory, which is concerned with the following situation. So now let's consider just smooth projective variety. And now we work over some finite field FQ. And so if you're in this situation, I mean, sort of, for each n, you have a finite Oberfield fq to the n. And so you can consider the set of points of your variety over this finite Oberfield. And so this will be a finite set, because it will be over a finite field. And so this is finite. And so in some sense, the Weyl conjectures are considered as a question, like how do these finite numbers behave, and how is this related to the geometry of your variety x? And so then, so these things are called Weyl conjectures still, but in fact this is a theorem due to Grossendieck, Berlin. There are many people here. So you get the following result. So first of all, what is the good way to arrange all these numbers? So you can write down the following generating series. So this will be some power series, which I get by taking first the sum over all n at least 1. So I take this point count over fq to the n. I divide it by n, t to the n. And then I take the exponential of this. So this makes sense as a formal power series over q. So a priori, it's not clear why exactly this is the right way to arrange these numbers, but it turns out that this is, for example, and in some sense consider this as an analog over finite fields of the Riemann zeta function. And so what kind of properties does this this power series have. So first of all, turns out that this is actually a rational function over Q. So it's really a quotient of two polynomial, which is already not clear at all from this definition as a power series. And then, in fact, one can say more. One gets a certain canonical factorization into certain polynomials, which looks as follows. So theta x of t. So we have a certain numerator. We get certain polynomials p1 of t up to p2g minus 1 of t. Then downstairs, we get certain polynomials p0 of t up to p2g of t. And these have the following properties. So first, they have integral coefficients, and the constant term of each of these guys is 1. This is some kind of normalization. And then the important thing is that the following statement is that every complex root of pi of t as absolute value q to the I over 2. Okay, and so in some sense, like this statement here should be, it's like I said before, this theta function is an analog of the Riemann theta function. This statement here is an analog of the Riemann hypothesis, because in some sense it tells you where the poles of this theta function are. Okay, and so let me note that sort of, I mean, this, for example, implies that this factorization, which a priori I just wrote down some factorization, which could be whatever, but in fact, the second condition together with this normalization, so, I mean, this determines the PI unique. And then there's a final statement here, which is somehow why we're interested in this. So far I just worked with some smooth projective variety or FQ, but now I want to look at the situation where I actually have some kind of lift of this variety to characteristic zero. So I don't know, let's say consider F a local field, so a finite overfield of QP. So then in OF, in F we have the valuation ring. And Kf is the residue field, which will be a finite field. Let's say Kf is the Fq that we worked with before. Okay, and now, like I said, I want to consider a lift of my variety x. So I want to consider some kind of curly x over the spectrum of OF, a smooth projective variety, smooth projective schema, as I should say now. Okay, and so now the x I want that I looked at before, I want to take the special fiber. And now, okay, so I have the special fiber, and on the other hand, what I can also do is I can choose some embedding of my local field into the complex numbers, and then if I take the complex valued points of this, I will just get some smooth complex manifold. And then, in fact, what happens is that the degree of this polynomial is pi, which we got before, it's just the ith Betti number of this complex manifold. Which is just the dimension of the ith cohomology group for whatever cohomology you like. Let's take singular cohomology. This is in some sense like the real upshot why we're interested in. Okay, so yeah. I mean, if you have never seen this before, this may be a bit miraculous. And in fact, I mean, this is a very surprising statement, but Really, what this tells you is that you have this, smooth projective variety over the finite field. You associate the, zeta function, which is just determined by this point count. And what this tells you is really from this zeta function, you can already read off the Betti numbers of, any lift to characteristic zero, of any smooth projective lift. This is a very strong statement. And so the upshot is this. This is what I just said. And in the end, I mean, we want to compare Hodge numbers, but let's just look at Betti numbers for now. So if we have like two x and y over the spectrum of OF, and we want to compare the Betti numbers, it's enough to look at the special fiber and compare the point counts. This is in some sense the central idea of this. And so now let me make some remark about, like, if you never have seen this sort of arithmetic arguments before, I mean, you might wonder if you start out with a variety over the complex numbers, how precisely do you get to this finite field? So let me explain this a bit. This is somehow called spreading out. So this is a very general argument. So let's say we have finitely many varieties over the complex numbers, plus some morphisms between them. Plus some properties. Right, so for example, you might want to remember that your varieties are smooth or something like this. So then there's the standard argument that allows you to deform this into some much more arithmetic setting. And the point is basically just this. So you have finitely many varieties and finitely many morphisms. So all of these things, I mean, each of them you can somehow describe by finitely many polynomials, and each polynomial has finitely many coefficients. Okay, and so what you can do is just take the subring of Z, let's call it R. So this is just the thing which is generated by all the coefficients. So this will be some finitely generated ring over Z. And now the point is basically just by construction, we've taken like we had all these polynomials, we just sort of remembered all these coefficients. So the same equations that describe that are original varieties and morphisms over the complex numbers, you can still write them down over this ring R. Okay, and so like what we see is that the varieties plus morphisms, they can canonically be defined over R. So everything that descends to spec R. And then finally, like I said, I mean, maybe we also have some properties of our varieties and morphism which we want to remember. Say, for example, that they're smooth. So of course, a priori, if you just take like any way of descending down to such a ring R, I mean, for example, the varieties don't have to be smooth anymore. But the fact, there's some general principle again here from algebraic geometry that tells you if you like know that the variety is smooth, so if you pass to the complex numbers, then it's already smooth if you work over some suitable open subset of R, the spectrum of R, I should say. So then sort of the upshot is that by localizing R, I get the properties. Over the spectrum of R. Okay, I mean, of course, this depends on properties, but in some sense, any reasonable algebra or geometric property that you can write down will satisfy this. Okay, so in this way, you can get to this finitely generated ring R over Z, and then okay, and then you can look at homomorphisms from R to OF where for local fields F. And some of the point is that there will be a lot of them. So now this R, which basically gives you a variety of finite type over spec set, and so for any closed point, then you can find some local fields around that. And so you have many, many ways to look at such embeddings into the local rings, and you can work with that. This is in some sense this general argument how you get to this situation. And then like I explained before, so the wave conjectures already tell you that if you look at the single such embedding, and you know that you have the same point counts over the residue field of the resulting finite field, the resulting local field, then you know that the varieties you started out with, if you do this for two different varieties, will have the same Betti numbers. And now, in fact, we want to do more. We want to actually compare the Hodge numbers. And so in fact, you can do the same thing by some even deeper results from arithmetic geometry if you don't just look at the single such embedding, but like a whole lot of them. This maybe I won't explain too much, but let me write some theorems. So the Chebotarev density theorem. Plus a comparison theorem from periodic Hodge theory. So this is the two far things. We know that if x and y over a spectrum spec R have the same point count over KF for sufficiently many such embeddings from R into OF, then X of C and Y of C have the same Hodge numbers. Okay, and so in this way, you can sort of, by this deformation argument, basically reduce to the case where everything is defined over the ring of integers of a local field, and you just have to compare the point counts. Reduce x, y, spec OF, and now we want to compare the point counts . So here how do we do this? So this is where the periodic integration from the title of my talk comes into play. So this is somehow a quite old idea of Weyl, which gives us a certain method to do this. So look at, I don't know, maybe I just call it straight X now. So X over spec OF, a smooth scheme. So then what you can do, you can sort of do the following. So you can somehow, so we have this local field F, which comes equipped with evaluation. And in some sense, you can sort of try to look at this as some kind of analytic manifold over F. And so X of OF, so it's locally, you can just cover this with some open balls OF to the N. In some analytic sense, where here analytic just means like given by some power series over OF. And so on this thing here, we have a Haar measure, the natural Haar measure given by the evaluation on this thing. And sort of Weyl's idea is in some sense to extend this locally defined Haar measures to a global measure on this set X of OF. And so basically what you do is you take like maybe locally on X of OF, you take some volume form on X of OF and you integrate it against this Haar measure, and this will give you a well-defined global measure on X of OF. Locally And so now somehow the crucial point of this is that now the volume of the whole set of X of OF just counts for you the number of points over the residue field, namely what you get is the number of points over the residue field divided by the order of this residue field to the dimension of X. Okay, and so some of the point is just that, like, for any point over KF, you can look at all the OF valued points which reduce to this point in the residue field. And this will give you some ball. And so because this thing is smooth, all these balls, in fact, will have the same volume, which is somehow given by this. And so this is how you see that you exactly get this computation from the volume. And so then, okay, and so now somehow from this, the upshot is that if you now have like two such X and Y over the spectrum of F and you want to compare the point count, you can somehow look at this canonical measures which you have here, and you just have to show that these two spaces have the same measures. Okay, and so now let me explain how we can prove the theorem using these ideas.
Is it obvious that the Higgs bundle, the space of Higgs bundles, is on an algebraic curve, is an algebraic variety?
Yeah, I mean, this is like, I mean, you have to construct this. And this is, I guess, what Simpson did. Using the semi, sorry?
Positive stability conditions and everything?
Yeah, you have
the stack.
No, put the, it's a moduli space of semi-stable Higgs models. So. Yeah, I mean, no, this requires certainly some work. And it's a theorem of Simpson, I guess, in the general case.
And when you want to define it over some other field, do you... It's the curve onto the field first?
Yeah, it's still, I mean, you just basically have to deform the curve and maybe this line bundle which we chose, and then you again get the moduli space from that.
Yeah. So there is a notion of its bundle over.
Yeah, I mean, you can write down the same notion. I mean, you have a vector bundle and a morphism of vector bundles, and it's completely algebraic, so
you can
do this.
But in a form?
Sorry?
Can you still define forms? The Higgs field is an endomorphism of the bundle tensor K.
Yeah.
It's still a K, you say.
Yeah, there's still differential forms. I mean, they still make sense over any algebraic, over any reasonable algebraic variety. Yeah. Okay. So the proof. I mean. Okay, so by these sort of arguments which I explained, I mean, so first of all, you look at the corresponding situation.
Sorry, another question.
Over F. Yes?
Is this true also for flat connections or only for Higgs bundles?
No, you can also do this for flat connections, I think. Yeah. But I mean, for us, this doesn't matter. It just works with the moduli space of Higgs bundles. But yeah.
And
you can do it, I guess, at least for like Durham flat or something.
Sorry?
But is there still a notion of one being the formation of the other? Meaning, so Higgs bundles are the formation of isolated flat connections, so the formation of Higgs bundles.
Yeah,
is this still true over?
Yeah, I think you can still, I mean, the family should still make sense, I believe. I mean, of course, I mean, you can't say that the two varieties are diffeomorphic anymore or something like this. I'm not sure, like, how much of this survives. I mean, some of the family you can still write down like this.
So I say the family is flat. That's the
other one,
I suppose.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So if you count points, you'll get the same answers.
I'm not sure, actually. Okay, so to prove the theorem, we look at the situation over OF. And then, okay, let me maybe abbreviate the notation. So let me denote M1, the SLN space. And to the PGLN space. And so now, I mean, somehow, I mean, the situation now is a bit more complicated than before. So first of all, our varieties are no longer compact, which I somehow assumed for the Weyl conjectures, and we also have to deal with these curves which show up. And so what happens is that we get a periodic measure like before. And so now this, since we have stacks, we have to work with the coarse moduli space. So we take for the M2, which is a stack, we take the associated coarse moduli space and we look at the OF valued points of that. And so in this we get a periodic measure like before. And now what happens is that we get certain integrable functions on these spaces. And so before, somehow I explained that one just has to compare the two volumes, which just amounts to integrating the function, which is constant equal to 1. So now here, in particular, because we have these curves, and these curves will induce some functions, which will in general be very much non-constant, but somehow the integrals still determine the whole situation. And so we get these two functions. And so similar to what I explained before, to prove the identity of this point count, it's enough to show that the integrals of these two functions are the same. Okay, so this is somehow how this periodic integration business works out in this more general situation. And so now the idea is to actually use the geometric situation which we have. So we have these two Hitchin vibrations to the common base. And the idea is to compute these integrals now fiber by fiber. So we have some kind of Fubini theorem that tells us again that the integral on each of these sides of the function fi. You can write this first as an integral over the base, and then as an integral over the fiber. And furthermore, the integral that you get on the base is the both on both sides, because I mean it's just determined by some volume form. We choose the same one on both sides. And so then the upshot is that it's enough to show that, in fact, on each of the fibers, the integral is the same. And so here, I mean, a priori, one should here integrate over OF valued points. But in fact, these fibers are now proper, so we can as well just write the F valued points. And so like I said, it suffices to show that for each fiber, these two integrals are the same. In fact, now there's another very important step. So after you have this fiber-wise identity, you still integrate over A of OF. And so what it tells you is that, in fact, in proving this, you can somehow throw away a set of measure zero in A of OF. And so, in fact, what I want to do is that sort of I want to only consider these points in A of OF such that, let me call A restricted to F, sort of the image of this in A of F. So all we know somehow, or all I said at least, is that sort of generically we have nice fibers which are given by abelian varieties. And so I want to only consider such points over OF, such that over the generic fiber we're in this situation, such that the OF torsors under abelian varieties. And basically, because this condition is somehow generically given by some Sarisky closed subset, it's easy to see that for these Haar measures, this will give a set of measure zero. And so one only needs to consider this. And, I mean, this is some a very important step because you see, I mean, generically these vibrations are very nice, but like then they degenerate somehow, and these degenerations I think are very bad and very poorly understood. And so here is sort of one of the main points which this whole periodic integration business gives you is that you can in some sense just forget about these bad fibers. Okay, and then let me finally sort of say a little bit about how one compare how one can compare these fiber-wise integrals. So fix such an A in OF. A in A of OF. And so now, now you can look at these fibers. And so like I said before, these things, they will only be torsors under abelian varieties, not abelian varieties themselves. So it can happen, and in fact, this will happen in general, that these fibers, the F-value points, they can actually be empty. This is something one also needs to take into account. Let's for now consider the situation where they are not empty. And then the sort of the last main point is that it's the following. So we can now, I mean, now we can really fix an identification, II of F is the abelian variety, so let me denote this P1, the abelian variety which acts here, and P2, the abelian variety which acts in the other sense. So we have this torsor, so we can identify this with the F-value points of Pi. And so we have this function F from Pi of F, so the complex numbers which we want to integrate. And so this can be also described as follows. So in this situation, we have these two abelian varieties. And remember, we haven't yet used the fact that they're dual to each other. This is some of the last ingredient what one needs. So we have this. In this setting, one has so-called tape duality, which gives you a perfect pairing between the points of Pi of F and the first flat cohomology group of the dual group. To Q mod C. So here, I fixed some I, and I prime is the other guy. And so what one has in this situation, sort of from the arithmetic theory of abelian varieties of a local field, is a perfect pairing. So perfect just means non-degenerate between the points of one of the abelian varieties and a certain first cohomology group, so this is flat cohomology, but I mean, don't worry so much about what this means, of the other guy. And so now what happens is, so this thing here exactly classifies isomorphism classes of Pi prime torsors over F. And so in fact, we exactly have such a guy, namely the second fiber. So the second fiber will exactly give us a class like this. And so now, in fact, what happens is that this function fi can exactly be described by this Tate duality. So what happens is that fi evaluated at some point is just the pairing of this point with the class of the second fiber. So this goes a priori from Pi of F to Q mod Z, and somehow one has embed this into C by the choice of some complex roots of unity. But so the point is that if one sets things up in the right way, this function Fi, which a priori comes from this term in a total different way, can be described by this Tate duality pair. Okay, and so I guess I'm almost out of time, so let me just tell you that sort of from this, It's really sort of you get quite directly the identity of integrals. So you can, for example, you can consider the factor where one of the fibers is actually empty, and the other one is not. So this is something that can really happen. So we want to show that the integral over the second fiber is also zero, the non-empty fiber. And so, in fact, what happens is that because the first fiber is empty, this class here of this fiber will, the pairing with this, because this pairing is non-degenerate, will be some non-trivial character of this function pi of f. We get some non-trivial character. Now we're integrating this over the abelian variety. But now remember, the measure on the abelian variety, it's defined by a top degree differential form. So an abelian variety or any group scheme, this will be translation invariant. So we have a translation invariant measure. Now we're integrating some non-trivial character against this translation invariant measure. So basically, you just get a non-trivial character sum which will vanish. So this will exactly tell you that if one of the fibers is empty, the other integral will also vanish. Okay, and so then there remain two other cases. So first of all, it can happen that both fibers are empty. Of course, in this case, both of them will be both integrals will be zero. And then there's a last case where both fibers are non-empty. And so in this case, both of these torsos are trivial. So basically, on both sides, you're just integrating the function which is constantly equal to one. And so you just end up having to compare the two volumes of these two dual abelian varieties. And then there is a fact that if you have these two dual abelian varieties by duality, you get a symmetric isogeny between them, and then you can again compute that they have the same volume. Let me stop here. Thank you.
Questions for Paul?
I remember in the 90s, people were doing a lot about motivic integration as a characteristic zero version of Piaget integration.
Yes, so this, I mean,
techniques here?
Yeah, this is an interesting question which we would like to think about. I mean, in principle, it should be possible, but for example, at the very end, we very crucially use this state duality. And so somehow you would need a version of this maybe for like Lorentz series field over the complex numbers. And this is not known at the moment. So first of all, you would have to develop something like this, which is not clear to us at the moment how to do this. But in principle, it would be quite interesting to actually do this as motivic integration, yes. Yes?
So how much did you really use about Hitchin systems? It seems like kind of at the end of the day, most of this would go through if I like had two SYZ dual systems that had kind of sufficient smoothness and sufficient.
Well, first of all, I mean, what we really use, of course, is that these morphisms are algebraic,
okay.
Which, I mean, of course, I mean, we won't have for take an arbitrary mirror pair, I guess. I mean, there's no reason to assume that any of this will be algebraic. And then it is true that in some sense you have a much more general theorem, which basically just looks like a sort of certain algebraic pair of dual integrable systems. Because, for example, I didn't really say this, but so the result we have now is just for SLN and PGLN. In fact, one should expect the same thing for any pair of Langlands dual groups. And in fact, the only problem is here is that at the very beginning, we had sort of this twisting procedure for SLN to actually get a smooth moduli space. And this hasn't been carried out for other reductive groups. But in principle, like the end result in periodic integration that we have should also apply in a more general context. Yes.
Other questions for Paul? He'll be around all afternoon, so you can also plug him there. If not, we should thank him again.